It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. If you've bought prescription drugs recently, consider this. Medication is the third most expensive item in our healthcare system. It's about 10% of what we spend overall on healthcare, and it was about half that much 30 years ago. Today, NPR's Elise Spiegel looks at one thing that's been driving this change: television advertising.
Ann Nissan is a 17-year-old student who lives in Prescott, Arizona. David Cooper is 49, a career counselor based in L.A. And then there's Samantha Severi. She's 26, works in Baltimore, Maryland, a transportation planner. Three very different people in three very different places whose stories all begin the same way, with a couch and a television.
I remember sitting on the couch.
We were watching Jeopardy.
On my sofa, probably a rerun of House.
So there they are, in Arizona and California, in Maryland, enjoying a small moment of peace away from school and work and life. And then out of the darkness, at a slightly increased volume, comes the message.
The commercial begins with a yellow and green landscape.
A little creature who sort of jumps up and down is kind of vaguely evil.
It looked like it was a party setting up on a rooftop. You know, big city type of thing.
And the narrator started talking about symptoms that some people struggle with, including constipation, diarrhea,
fungus,
PMS, and the cramps and everything.
And then it says, you can take this drug and everything will be fine.
You see, David had been struggling with this infection on his toe and had terrible cramps. And Samantha found herself rushing to the bathroom at odd times. Then suddenly, right in front of them, the answer.
It stuck in my mind.
That's exactly what I need.
I think it made me feel hopeful.
There was just one more thing that Anne and David and Samantha needed to do. One more hurdle between them and salvation. To solve their problem, they needed a prescription.
So then I went to my doctor.
Then we just went to my doctor.
So I made an appointment with my doctor.
Just basically said, look, I really want to try this.
I brought up the name of the medication.
This wonder drug.
And do you think it would work for me? If so, you know, hit me up.
Today, the average American gets 12 prescriptions a year. In 1992, we got on average 7 prescriptions a year. That's a 58% increase, which costs American society about $180 billion more dollars. Now, there are more medicines on the market today than there were in 1992. But researchers think that around 20% of that $180 billion increase has absolutely nothing to do with the number of medications available or the cost of that medication. What does it have to do with? Direct-to-consumer advertising.
Okay, my name is Joe Davis, and we're in Vermont. Wilder, Vermont. I used to be wild, and now I'm wilder.
Joe Davis is retired now, but in his speech and manner, it's easy to hear the breezy salesmanship that made him so successful. Davis, you see, was an ad man.
I was trained, or I was toilet trained, as we like to say, in packaged goods. General Foods, Procter & Gamble, this kind of thing.
Now, some history here for context. Until very recently, the 1980s and 90s, the kind of people who sold stuff like packaged goods were really different from the kind of people who sold stuff like prescription drugs. Drug ads were designed by people who worked at these small, technically minded medical advertising companies. Companies that only targeted this small, technically minded audience. Drug ads, says Davis, were for doctors.
Nobody had ever thought that these drugs should be or could be or would be advertised to the consumer or the patient because they thought only doctors could understand the products, their technical products.
But really it was more than that. There was this fear shared by doctors and drug companies alike that advertising drugs directly to consumers could be harmful. Because though consumers couldn't really evaluate whether or not a drug was appropriate, they might become convinced by an ad and then pressure their doctor to prescribe it. Also, it might disrupt the doctor-patient relationship. See, at the time, the doctor-patient relationship was mostly a one-way street. Joe Davis tells this story about his own mother, a sophisticated woman who Davis found fumbling with a bottle of pills one day. Davis says he asked what she was taking.
Well, she said, I take a yellow pill, a green pill, and a white pill. I say, that's great. What are they for? Well, she said, I don't know. Why do you take them? Well, the doctor told me to take them. So it was very passive from the patient's standpoint.
So doctors decided what to prescribe, and drug companies, through medical advertisers, tried to influence doctors. But, says Davis, the system wasn't working out well for the drug companies.
The whole problem with this system is, that it's very slow.
Even though drug companies spent an enormous amount of time and money trying to change the prescribing behavior of doctors, that process often took years. And because of patents, the amount of time companies had to make money off their products was limited. And so Joe Davis, the man from packaged goods, contacted this guy named William Castagnoli, then president of one of the larger medical advertising companies, and the two came up with a solution.
Why not talk to the patient and have the patient go in and ask the doctor for the drug and pull it through the system?
Problem was, this was almost impossible to do. At the time, the early 80s, FDA regulations required that when drug ads included both the name of a drug and its purpose, side effect information must also be included. But side effect information could take mountains of mouse print to catalog. Here's Castagnoli.
In the newspapers, it would take up a whole page.
But, says Castagnoli, there was almost no way to make it work on television.
Because we couldn't scroll the whole disclosure information over the television screen, okay?
But then in 1986, while designing an ad for a new allergy medication called Celdane, Davis finally hit on a way around the regulations. After checking to make sure the FDA wouldn't object, here is what they did.
We didn't give the drug's name, Celdane. All we said was, your doctor now has treatments that won't make you drowsy. See your doctor.
This was one of the very first national direct-to-consumer television ad campaigns, and the results were nothing short of astounding. Davis says before the ads, Celdane sold about $34 million a year, which was actually considered pretty good.
Our goal was maybe to get this drug up to $100 million in sales. But we went through $100 million, and we said, holy smokes. And then it went through $300 million. And then it went through $500 million. $600 million. It was unbelievable. We were flabbergasted. And eventually went to $800 million.
Pharmaceutical companies clearly took note. Today, drug companies spend $4 billion a year on ads to consumers. The regulations now permit TV drug ads to name both the drug and what it's for, as long as major risks are disclosed. And the Nielsen Company estimates there's an average of 80 drug ads every hour of every day on American television. Julie Donahue is a professor of public health at the University of Pittsburgh, and she says those ads clearly produce results.
Something like a third of consumers who've seen a drug ad have talked to their doctor about it. About two-thirds of those have asked for a prescription, and a majority of people who ask for a prescription have that request honored.
Now, whether the increase in the number of prescription drugs taken is good or bad for patient health is an open question. There's evidence on both sides. What's not up for debate is this. By taking their case to patients instead of doctors, drug companies increase the amount of money that Americans spend on medicine. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. How energy efficient is your home? Maybe you've weather-stripped your doors or sealed a drafty window, but can you move your walls depending on where the sun is or monitor your electricity usage with your phone? Those are just some of the features on display here in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall. 20 teams are competing in this year's Solar Decathlon. The goal is to design, build, and operate the most attractive, effective, and energy-efficient solar-powered house. And as NPR's David Gura reports, there's efficient, and then there's efficient.
I'm standing on the National Mall just to the east of the Washington Monument. The Capitol building is to my left. And in front of me is a small neighborhood, 20 homes, each of which is really, really energy-efficient.
So this is the Refract House?
Kyle Belcher is standing outside one of the houses, greeting visitors.
This home provides about 150% of its peak energy needs. So on a day like today, we're producing a net surplus of energy and giving energy back into the power grid.
It's a warm fall morning, and the sun is shining. Refract House is tube-shaped.
It pivots around a beautiful deck made out of reclaimed elm wood. The roof is filled with solar panels. Its insulation is made out of recycled denim. And every appliance and light fixture is connected to a software program called the Building Dashboard.
From anywhere in the world, when you're on vacation in Hawaii, you can log in online and see how your house is doing in terms of energy usage, energy production, even water usage.
Noah Greer is an architecture student at the California College of the Arts. He says you can use Building Dashboard, which is commercially available, to open and close window shades, to turn lights on and off, and to adjust the house's heating and cooling systems. In North House, another building in the competition, there's a similar interface, integrated into the design. Johnny Rogers, a master's student at Simon Fraser University, shows me a screen built into the kitchen wall. Then he reaches into his pocket and pulls out an iPhone. North House has its own iPhone application. He taps the screen.
You land at a page that provides feedback on your energy consumption and solar energy production.
It's elegant, with bright, colorful graphs, and it's smart.
Your house also provides you with alerts that are sent to your phone so that you can see tips, information on consumption, so that you can adjust your house systems on the fly.
Another house in the solar decathlon, called Lumen House, also has a sophisticated computer system and an iPhone app. Incredibly, you can use a smartphone to change how the building looks. On each side of the house, there are giant metal panels. They're programmed to open and close depending on where the sun is in the sky. So if it's a particularly clear night and you want to look out the window at the stars, you can override the system to keep those panels open. Judging in the solar decathlon will continue till Friday. David Gura, NPR News.
Michael Jackson's death in June put an end to his planned comeback tour, but his career continues.
This is it. Here I stand. I'm the light of the world. I feel grand. This love.
This is it. That's a Jackson song that was just released today. Michael Jackson isn't the only performer to have songs released after his death. Tupac Shakur, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, and many others have released whole albums of so-called new material. Well, that got us thinking about the lucrative market of licensing and managing the images and the work of dead celebrities. And there's no better person to turn to than Mark Rossler. His company, CMG Worldwide, handles publicity rights for dozens of celebrities who've died. And he joins us now from his office in Indianapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle. Nice to be on the program with you.
Apparently, there is a lot of unreleased Michael Jackson music out there. Is there some serious earning potential here?
Well, sure there is. I mean, what we've seen with Michael Jackson is something that we've seen in the past with the likes of Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, James Dean, and these are the fact that these legendary personalities have stood out over time, and they're going to be remembered not only for the next few years, but for the next few generations.
Now, Mr. Rossler, as I understand, you don't represent the Michael Jackson estate, but as you look at this career and the span of his career, what will be the challenges in trying to manage that portfolio?
Well, the immediate challenge is going to be to get your arms around everything that's out there, because he had such global appeal that there are things happening all over the world. I mean, there are 7 billion people in the world, and only 5% of those are in the United States. But there's another 95% of the world's population out there that needs to be addressed, that knows who Michael Jackson was, and I'm sure there's a lot going on.
You know, as we noted, there's a lot of unreleased Michael Jackson music out there. How do you balance the release in this and making sure that you don't give in to the impulse, I guess, to put as much of this out there as fast as possible to satisfy the public, or also balancing the interest in looking at this or listening to it carefully to make sure that you're not releasing songs that maybe weren't released for a reason?
I think in the case of Michael Jackson, it's well known that he was in a lot of financial debt at the time of his death. And because of that, I think his estate is very concerned about how they dig out of the debt and they provide for his family in the future. So I think what you see is a very concerted effort to maximize the financial revenue for the estate, not only so they can dig out of the financial hole that they were in, but so they can provide for his family.
Michael Jackson was a real perfectionist, and some of the music that was not released, as I understand, was not released because it didn't meet his standards. How do you balance the interest of getting music out there that the public might be interested in, but also remaining true to the artist's original desires?
I think that's why you need good management in a situation like this. Michael Jackson is the goose that lays the golden egg here, so he has to be protected as we move down the road now.
Mark Rassler is with CMG Worldwide, that's based in Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. Rassler, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Michelle. My pleasure. This is it.
Mark Rassler was talking to us about handling the work of dead celebrities on a new song, as a new song was released from Michael Jackson, and that song is called This Is It. And this is All Things Considered from NPR News. The perennial presidential candidate and social critic Ralph Nader is staking out new territory. He's published a novel, a 700-page novel, a really big, thick book. It's called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Alan Chews has a review.
So here's Ralph Nader trying to be a Tom Wolfe in sheep's clothing. He's pimping up an argument about how Americans might organize a movement to take back government from special interests. And he expects readers to come along for a 700-page ride. This is how it goes. More than a dozen or so of the retired super-rich, under the direction of Warren Buffett, set the plan in motion over the course of less than a year. There's George Soros, Ted Turner, Ross Perot, and William Gates Sr., among other billionaires, and some wealthy entertainers, Bill Cosby, Yoko Ono, and Warren Beatty, who pitch in. America, to all of them, is a land where there's only liberty and justice for some. Point well made. And they want the Pledge of Allegiance to truly cover all citizens. From a headquarters in Maui, yikes, these social critics really know how to live, they establish their movement and set up groups to organize labor and some sympathetic businessmen and attempt to convince a reluctant Congress and president that their path remains the best way to walk the walk. Corporations try to block them and defame them to no avail. When Walmart falls in line, you know you're in a true fantasy. And when Rush Limbaugh, in these pages known as Bush Bimbaugh, loses a live radio debate to Ted Turner, you know you're in the middle of an hysterical fantasy. At 100 pages, the book might have been a bearable fable. At 700 plus, it's an unconscionable attack on America's trees.
Ouch. Ralph Nader's new novel is called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Our reviewer is Alan Chews. He assures us his latest book, A Trance After Breakfast, is not 700 pages long. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. For years, animal rights groups in Europe have tried to get Spain to ban bullfighting. Now, American rodeo promoters are offering an alternative. Dozens of America's top rodeo cowboys have taken their show to Europe. The tour is starting at Spanish bullfighting rings. Jerome Sokolowski went out to a show to see how the rodeo was playing in Spain.
A bilingual MC tries to fire up the crowd in the municipal bullring of Guadalajara, a small city near Madrid. Out come the Harley-Davidsons with Miss Rodeos waving the stars and stripes. And then the cowboys rope steer and ride broncos as the high-decibel sound system shakes the foundations of the arena.
Here in the bullring, you normally find crowds watching in silence as matadors face down bulls in a fight to the death. This is something completely different, and it sure is a culture shock for many of the people here.
An elderly lady with a perfect hairdo sits primly, clutching a purse on her lap.
It's muy curioso.
This is very odd, says Josefina Palafox, who didn't plan to be here. She and a senior friend were just out for an evening stroll. And we saw the commotion and decided to see what it was all about, she says. It's very American, she adds, and we like it. Well, not quite. The friend, Conchita Ruza, is not so keen.
los toros.
I'll stick to the bullfights, she says. They're a lot nicer.
Lo primero, no está este barullo.
First of all, you don't have all this racket. Secondly, the bull is a beautiful animal. And lastly, she says, I'm Spanish.
Luego soy española.
Uno, dos, tres. Yeah!
The crowd enthusiastically takes part in a yeehaw contest. But outside the ring, there's been criticism of the rodeo. One commentator in El Mundo newspaper argued that rodeos in Spain are as culturally misplaced as recent efforts to bring bullfighting to the U.S. Still, these rodeos celebrate a facet of Americana that European cultural snobs love to sneer at. The flag waving, the country music, and everywhere there are cowboys in 10-gallon hats.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
My name is Jerome Sokolovsky. I'm with National Public Radio in the U.S.
Cool. Mike Beers from Oregon. I'm a world champion team roper from the States, and I come over here for the month we're over here.
He thinks the rodeo will be a hit in Spain. Increasing numbers of people tell pollsters here that they feel queasy about bulls being killed in the ring.
You know, they're used to seeing the bull, when they get done with him here, they drag him out on a sled. We rope the steer by the feet here. We get done with him, he jumps up and runs out of the arena. The crowd loves it.
These children are more accustomed to shouting olé at bullfighters. But 10-year-old Alba Perez says she loves animals and now prefers the rodeo.
Porque hacen más cosas.
Because they do more stuff, she says, and they don't kill the bull. The rodeo may have its origins in the American West at a time when it belonged to Spain. But this spectacle couldn't be more un-Spanish, and that's a big part of its appeal here. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Guadalajara, Spain.
1 year after the Wall Street meltdown, Bank of America is still facing problems associated with its speedy takeover of Merrill Lynch. The latest is that Ohio's attorney general has filed a class action lawsuit. It's on behalf of the state's public pension plans and Ohioans who say they lost serious money. From Ohio Public Radio, Joe Ingles reports.
Last year about this time, all eyes were on a jittery Wall Street. The country's financial leaders hoped Bank of America would follow through with its plan to acquire the embattled brokerage firm Merrill Lynch. That happened, but Bank of America shareholders like Aristotle Huttris of Columbus, Ohio, say they lost money as a result.
I'm pretty angry, and I do think the anger is justified.
Huttris is not just one of thousands of Ohioans invested in the state's pension plans. He is a state employee in charge of a board working on ways to shore up those funds for future retirees. Huttris is angry that the state's two largest funds lost tens of millions of dollars in Bank of America's stock after the deal.
They had information and didn't share it with the public plans, and had the public plans and any other investor known the facts, the results would have been different because they probably wouldn't have invested the money and wouldn't be out the loss.
That's the crux of a class action lawsuit filed by Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray on behalf of the state's pension plans. He accuses Bank of America officials of misleading investors by withholding important information prior to and during the acquisition of Merrill Lynch. Cordray also slams the bank for paying millions of dollars in bonuses to Merrill Lynch executives.
The Wall Street executives here and the people running these companies, we believe, you know, engaged in greedy, shoddy, self-serving practices.
On October 6th of last year, one share of Bank of America stock sold for more than $32. In March, 2 months after the merger, the same share was worth about $3. It now hovers around $17 a share. Scott Pattison heads the National Association of State Budget Officers. He says other states are watching this case closely.
Certainly, if Ohio is successful, I think that you'll see a lot of other states and localities look to what kind of other legal remedies that they might have.
But Richard Bove, who's with the firm Rockdale Securities, takes issue with the claims that Bank of America stock lost value because the company failed to properly disclose information to shareholders.
I have a lot of trouble believing that it's true.
Beauvais says the bank did what was necessary to make the dicey merger happen smoothly.
As a result of what Bank of America did, tens of thousands of people still have their jobs, are still operating out of New York, and are still being paid reasonable incomes.
In a written statement, Bank of America says it's confident that it disclosed all that was required and looks forward to presenting its position to the court. But Ohio State University law professor Paul Rose thinks Bank of America will be motivated to eventually settle the suit. And he thinks that's probably what Ohio wants, too.
Settlements are actually higher when you have public pension funds involved in a securities class action lawsuit. Furthermore, since again, they are often still invested in the company while they're bringing a suit for the sale of some of their shares. They often are not trying to bring the company down by any means. So you'll see a settlement often coupled with some sort of corporate governance change or something that they feel is really important.
For NPR News, I'm Joe Ingles in Columbus, Ohio.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.